The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Nations League dream is over for England. A 2-0 defeat in Belgium means they can at least have two games off in October 2021. But what was this? A good performance from a side slowly improving in a new formation against the best team in the world? Or a complete disaster? Southgate must go, all the players are rubbish, they're not fit to wear the shirt type thing. Anyway, who cares what happens as long as Jack Grealish has the ball at his feet? Elsewhere, Wales are one game away from promotion to Group A, but that means yet another defeat for Stephen Kenny. Scotland lose in the hangover off in Slovakia and Northern Ireland go down in Austria. There's Ramos missing two penalties. There's no place for Sivertsen in Norway's completely new squad as their first one isn't allowed out of the country. In the WSL, late comebacks for Chelsea and Manchester United. We'll answer all your questions as well. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendening. Good morning.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm really marvellously well. Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Ah, yes. As well as I was when Barry asked. Hi, Jonathan Liu.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Johnny. Nice of you to ask. Yeah, let's start then with Belgium 2, England 0. Should we start with the positives, or at least the positive that I think everyone can agree on, which is Jack Grealish? Rob Smythe writing, I think he'll become undroppable between now and June. He looks like a player who's taking a shortcut to greatness. On current form, he'd be in contention for a World 11, never mind England. Good to build him up as much as we can. But Johnny, he was sensational yesterday, wasn't he?
He was all right.
Oh, okay.
I thought he was quite good. He didn't... He had a couple of openings. He created chances in the final third. You know, he got in the 6-yard box a couple of times. He looked bright. It was a good sparky performance. I think that, you know, the Grealish trade has gathered probably a little bit too much momentum. I think he's a guy who's in terrific form for his club, who is still finding his way in the international game and is not the solution or the answer or the messiah that people are looking for. He's all right. He's good. He played all right. He's fine. They'll probably take him to the Euros.
Any advances on that, Ed?
I know what Johnny's saying. He's not the messiah, but he's a very no. I think he was superb. But whether, you know, obviously we did lose the game, and he could have perhaps created a bit more, maybe. I mean, the whole team were lacking in creativity in the final third, and it was sort of quite a good performance up to the final third, and then it fell short. But yeah, in terms of Grealish, I think he's seizing his chance, isn't he? He's been waiting. He said after the game he's been waiting his whole life for this opportunity, and you know, he got the chance to play against Wales last month, and then was left out of the two Nations League games completely, much to everyone's surprise, and then comes in and for his first, you know, proper start and really just stole the show in terms of the England team. And it's now really for Southgate to find a place for him in the side, I think, going forward, because he looks that good.
Yeah, that turn he did where he just flicked it over his back and ran onto it was so nice. I guess the question, Barry, is it felt to me like a performance that means you can't not pick him now.
Well, you can not pick him. And Gareth Southgate has a difficult decision to make as to whether he wants to pick him or not. I would suggest he is making himself undroppable, but I wouldn't go too mad over that performance last night. There were some nice touches. There was a bit of creativity, but I think, like the England team as a whole, lack cutting edge. They did lose the game. As for him waiting all his life for this opportunity, funnily enough, he didn't happen to mention that when he was picking up his Football Association of Ireland Young Player of the Year award a couple of years ago. Perhaps he hasn't been waiting for that opportunity all his life. But anyway, I need to let that go. He's gone now. He played well. He was probably the standout player in the England team last night. You were saying in your introduction, you know, was it a brilliant performance or was it a terrible performance? I think you can make an argument for both cases. It was quite aesthetically pleasing. They were perhaps unlucky to lose because of the two goals that went in, a free kick that shouldn't have been given and a double deflection. But I'd be happy enough if I was an England fan with that.
Is the question, Johnny, you know, Southgate has to make a choice whether to play sort of three at the back, this 3-4-3, or to play a kind of 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1. And if he does one of them, England score loads of goals but let in loads of goals. And if he does the other, they don't score any goals and don't concede any goals. And which one of those is more likely to actually win you a tournament, when the answer is probably neither?
Well, I mean, this all stems back from England's 2019, where they were kind of free scoring, free flowing. They beat the Czechs 5-0. They beat, I think, Kosovo 5-3. There were seven goal maulings, and they looked like a really genuinely attacking team, an aesthetically pleasing team. But I don't necessarily think that's the way you win tournaments. I don't think that's the way you win games against big, strong nations like Belgium and you know, your Germanys and Spains and Frances. So this is clearly an ideological choice by Southgate. He wants three defenders. He wants a screen of two in front of them, essentially to defend with seven. And maybe that is the way that you deal with knackered players at the end of a really long season in a really short, you know, tournament, but tournament-based football where the bounce of the ball can go against you. The one thing we've learned from this international break is that there aren't actually any good international teams. There are some that are quite good, but nobody's a standout team. There are maybe a dozen teams that can win the Euros. And in order to be in that conversation, you need to not be making stupid mistakes at the back. You need to have attacking options that can nick a goal in what is going to be a very tight tournament. And that's clearly where they're heading. Whether it's the best way to win the public's affection is a different issue, but I think that's clearly how Southgate decided to go.
And so, Ed, in a way, is it kind of brave of Southgate to be sort of defensive like this? Because if it doesn't work, and the chances are England don't win the Euros, he'll get, you know, in terms of the public affection, he'll get panned because people want him to play every attacker that we have.
Yeah, I think there is a bit of a danger of that, really, because you look at some of the players that we've got at our disposal that, you know, attacking wise, that that could be involved. And, you know, we're kind of, like you mentioned, the formation. I think that's very important with this. It really limits, you know, talking about Grealish earlier, for example, with him, it limits where he can play, doesn't it? Because if we play that system, the 3-4-3, then Grealish can only play in one position, you know, up in the front line, because he can't be in one of the two central midfield positions. So, I mean, I'd be in favour of doing what Southgate looked like he was trying to do last year, and Johnny mentioned it, you know, when England were scoring, I think they were top scorers in the qualifiers for the Euros. And, you know, with two sitting midfielders and one slightly advanced player, which, you know, could potentially be Grealish. I don't know. I mean, he looked like Southgate talks about it yesterday, how he's happy to hold the ball, you know, go and take the ball in difficult positions and hold it. And I think that's really important if you're going to have that slightly advanced midfielder of the three, that you have somebody like that can take you up the pitch, which is kind of what we missed against Croatia, you remember, in the semi-final of the World Cup. So I'd like to see him go back to the four at the back, but I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, just because of the concerns with the defence.
Sure. So is the question then, is Grealish good enough to change the start, to change the formation, to have him in the 10? Or is that not the question? Is the question, do we have two good enough centre-backs?
I think it's a bit of both, yeah. And I think the number one question for him is your second question. Do we have two good enough centre-backs? And especially now Gomez is, you know, looks like he's going to be on the sidelines for a while. I think he was the one that Southgate earmarked as potentially playing along Maguire in the back four because of his extra, you know, good bit of pace to cover off Maguire's lack of pace. So I think that option is really fading fast, unless a really good centre-back suddenly pops his head up in the next few months who's capable of covering our lack of pace in our main defender.
We always say social media isn't a barometer, Baz, of anything, and we shouldn't be on it. And I do find watching England games while being on, you know, before the second half's even started, Harry Winks has been crucified just for being brought on the pit. I mean, I don't know. And it almost takes me into this sort of rut of becoming over-positive about what is kind of an okay team, as Johnny says, against the number one team in the world who also aren't brilliant but are quite good.
Well, you really do lose the run of yourself in terms of positivity, and I always feel compelled to rein you in a bit. Now, bear in mind, it makes no difference to me how England fare in the Euros. I won't lie, I would be bereft if they won it, but otherwise, if you look at that game last night, you could argue Belgium went ahead early, and from that point on, despite all their quite occasionally aesthetically pleasing build-up play, England barely laid a glove on them. The Belgian keeper didn't really have a save to make. England have, in their last five games, only scored one goal from open play. They would be sources of concern for me if I was an England fan. I personally think Gareth Southgate should go with a 4-3-3, but I don't think he will either. And I kind of think he's on a hiding to nothing, because unless England win the Euros, there are fans of clubs who all think their players should be in the England team. And if you look at some of the players who didn't play last night, okay, you've got James Maddison, Leicester fans will all think, oh, he should be in the England team. James Ward-Prowse, ditto for Southampton fans. Marcus Rashford, Mason Greenwood, Ross Barkley, the ghost of what Dele Alli used to be, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Tammy Abraham, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Danny Ings, Phil Foden. None of them played last night. Now, sadly for Gareth Southgate, there are only 11 places in a football team. A lot of very good players who would march into any other home country's side are going to be left out. And when they are left out, if England don't win the tournament, people will go, well, why didn't you pick him? Why didn't you pick him? They say it's a nice problem to have, but I don't think it is.
This is Euro 2016 all over again, when Roy Hodgson basically caved to the pressure of, we've got Sturridge, we've got to play Sturridge, we've got to play Jamie Vardy, we've got to play Rashford, we have to play Rooney, we have to play Raheem Sterling, and try to fit them all into this like incredibly 1950s style 4-2-4. And you ended up essentially with six players all just running into each other in the penalty area, and we all know how that ended. The clamour to try and fit in all these attacking players is one where I think is slightly divorced from reality. That you can't play Kane, Sterling, Grealish, Sancho, Rashford, Phil Foden. You know, this is not how football works, and the whole idea of trying to construct a tournament squad is to create a system that into which these players can fit in when required. But you know, do you really want all these players? You know, do you really want a team full of England attacking talent when you're coming up against France with Dembele and Mbappe running at you? England fans are idiots.
We also often forget, Ed, that there is an opposition. You know, there's another team who are sort of out there also trying to win the game and trying to stop you winning it. I mean, for example, Eric Dier was getting hammered yesterday, and Lukaku did bully him, but Lukaku is a sensationally good footballer.
He is a very good footballer, yeah. And it's like Belgium were pretty impressive as well, weren't they? No one's really talked about them. And you know, after the last month, when England were a bit lucky to beat them really in the first game, Belgium showed a bit more what they're all about really. And you know, Lukaku is, yeah, I think. Barney mentioned it in his column yesterday. You know, Lukaku's goal-scoring record, 57 goals in like 85 games, I think it is. It's just unbelievable. And that would make him, as he points out, England's by far England's record scorer already. So, yeah, I mean, I think Johnny mentioned this early on, there's not many great teams. I think he's right at the moment because, you know, we're so far out from the tournament. Everything's a bit chaotic, really, for national teams, even though they've been playing together for a while. But I think once the tournament is ready to start, there'll be some real contenders there, obviously. I think I've got a sneaky suspicion for Spain this time.
Philippe Auclair, talking yesterday on Twitter, said, look, I make it after Chilwell's injury. 88 Premier League players are now sidelined with injuries. It's a lot of footballers, Barry. And we discussed it before, haven't we? And I don't really know what the solution is, but we need to somehow give them some time off from playing football. Some time.
Well, that's not going to happen. I mean, Jurgen Klopp must be tearing his hair out. Jordan Henderson, I don't know how serious his injury is, or apparently he just felt tight around his hamstring, so it might not be a problem. But teams playing three internationals in this current break is lunacy. You're not getting a break on the international front because international football associations have contractual obligations and need to make money. You're not going to get a break on the domestic front. You know, they're even playing lower down, the absolutely redundant dead rubbers in the Papa John's Cup. You know, what is the point of that? Clubs just have to deal with it.
England play Iceland next up on the subject of meaningless games. There's another one for you, Barry. Belgium against Denmark will decide who goes to the finals after Denmark beat Iceland 2-1 with a very late Christian Eriksen penalty. Off the pitch, Marcus Rashford, the Daily Mail ran another one of these sort of embarrassing stories yesterday. What a result. Campaigning football star Marcus Rashford has bought 5 luxury homes worth more than £2 million. If you get 5 houses for £2 million, I mean, how luxury they're going to be. But Marcus Rashford says, let's address this. I'm 23. I came from little. I need to protect not just my future, but my family's too. To do that, I made a decision at the beginning of 2020 to start investing more in property. Please don't run stories like this alongside references to campaigning. What are your thoughts on this, Johnny?
Well, in a way, it's kind of the first little shot across the bows, isn't it? We saw a lot of Conservative MPs while he was undertaking his campaign in the October half term, trying to go for him, trying to have a little dig at him, for having the temerity to want to feed hungry children. And I think this story, which, you know, I think is kind of isolated at the moment. It's not part of a glut, but it is an attempt, I think, by the Mail to test the water, to see how far people are willing to go to see this guy taken down. And if there's an appetite for it, and people will have read it, I mean, I clicked on it, like lots of us will have clicked on it and read the story, that's how these things begin to snowball. And there comes a point where it's less about ideology, and it's less even about, you know, his race or his class or whatever, and it becomes a bit of a game. It becomes like hunting for sport. And I think that was a lot of what drove the Raheem Sterling coverage a couple of years ago. It may initially have been driven by really quite sinister motives, but by the time the thing snowballs, it becomes more about just doing it for fun. And I think there's a big element of the British media that has been waiting to come up with some sort of negative angle on Marcus Rashford because of the amount of acclaim he's rightfully got for his campaigning. Yeah, the fact that it is getting so much attention is not, I think, going to discourage the Mail from publishing more of these stories.
What's the right thing then for sort of normal right-thinking people to do?
Just to have his back, I guess. There was a good piece in Football 365 about this. This was like a few weeks ago, I think. You don't take on the government like this. You don't humiliate the Prime Minister without expecting some kind of blowback. I think this article was basically saying when that blowback comes, you just have Marcus Rashford's back because support him and make sure that these stories don't get the traction that they're intended to. Again, you know, it's a bit of a paradoxical one because you don't want to blow up this story into more than it is, and yet it so clearly is just wrong on every kind of conceivable level that it's hard not to shout about it. But that I guess is why these stories get written, because they're written to troll people as much as to inform people.
They must have known when that story would have been shared by so many people, you know, saying, oh, look at this, you know, this is outrageous. But that's what they want, isn't it? They want people to share that story so it gets as many clicks.
It's owning the libs.
Exactly. Yeah, getting as many clicks as possible for that story. And then it's a success, whether they're negative or positive clicks. They don't really care. It's just about the numbers, isn't it?
It is, I think, important to make the distinction as well that this story emanates from the big boy end of the paper rather than the sports section. I'd imagine, say, Ollie Holt, who works for the Mail on Sundays, reading that and cringing and is probably angry about it. I don't claim to speak for him, but I'm just knowing him as I do. I suspect he would be unhappy with that. It's also worth bearing in mind that the proprietor of the Daily Mail, Lord Rothermere, has a lot of property as well. all of his inherited, so he hasn't come from nothing. Marcus Rashford does seem to have good people around him advising him, and they don't seem to have put a foot wrong, but I would question the wisdom of him even dignifying that with a response or a rebuttal. There will be people who read that and use it as ammunition against him, and there's no point in giving people like that the time of day, in my opinion. You can be absolutely sure that the tabloids and papers like the Daily Mail will have been rooting around in the bins looking for dirt on him for quite a long time now. If that is the worst they can come up with, wealthy young man invests in property, then I think he's okay.
Some incredibly sad news is the death of Ray Clements, former England Liverpool Spurs goalkeeper, passed away at the age of 72. The young Clements was spotted by Bill Shankly playing for Scunthorpe United, was signed for £18,000 in June of 1967. He went on to win 5 league titles, 3 European Cups, 2 UEFA Cups, the FA Cup and the League Cup in over 665 first-team appearances before he left for Spurs in 1981. He was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer in 2005. He did so much amazing work for Prostate Cancer UK as well. They said he was, most importantly, an amazing man and a huge part of the Prostate Cancer UK family. Peter Shilton, who was obviously the rival for the England number one jersey for so many years, wrote, "I'm absolutely devastated to be told of the sad news that Ray Clements has passed away. We were rivals, but good friends. He was a brilliant goalkeeper with a terrific sense of humour. I'll miss him a great deal as we've kept friends a long time after retiring." And Liverpool tweeted out an absolutely beautiful tribute to him, which included the ovation he got on the Kop when he came back as a Spurs player at half-time in a game. And I think Ray Clements said it was like the most emotional that he'd felt on a football pitch. And I don't know if any of you had the pleasure of meeting him. I met him a few times and he was just an amazingly polite, gentle, friendly guy. And what a lot of people have said is, you know, he was suffering a lot with illness, but he never let it show. And the work he did for prostate cancer was quite unbelievable. And he was, you know, certainly on the occasions that I met him, he would ask me questions, you know, and that I think is a sign of always interested when you meet ex-sports people who are as interested in you as they are you in them. And he was
Please
a great.
Tell me, Max, you didn't tell him the Trevor Nelson microwave anecdote.
I think I spared him that. But he was a brilliant footballer as well, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bit before my time, but I do. Young people listening won't quite believe this, but back when I were a lad, you know, cue the wistful Hovis music, there wasn't a huge amount of football on television. And my main memories, or my initial memories of watching football is seeing Liverpool play a lot. And I'd have had posters of Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush and Ray Clements on my wall. And if I was a kid playing football, you know, you'd pretend to be someone. And if it was my turn in goals, I would always be Ray Clements when I was picking the ball out of the back of the net. I remember him, you know, being quite strikingly handsome man with his piercing eyes and his kind of strong lantern jaw. And I think one of my earliest football memories is watching the entirety of the 1982 FA Cup final. It was Tottenham against QPR. He was in goal for Spurs. I remember the QPR goalkeeper was a Culverhouse staple, Peter Hooker. And the first game was a draw, and Spurs won the replay 1-0. But he was the goalkeeper I wanted to be when I was a kid. And I mean, I was reading an article Paul Wilson wrote about him in The Guardian today. His first full season at Anfield, Liverpool conceded 24 goals in 42 league games. And then in 78-79, they conceded 12 goals in a season. I mean, that is just remarkable. Now, obviously, he had a wonderful defence in front of him. But my abiding memory, such as it is, because I was only, I don't know, 9 or 10 at the time, just how quick he was. And, you know, a through ball would be put in, and he would be off his line like a greyhound out of a trap. It was that sticks in my mind.
Obviously we send our best wishes to his family and friends, and that'll do for part one. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Wales 1, Ireland 0. Sorry, Barry. Wales will be promoted to the top tier of the Nations League if they avoid defeat at home to Finland on Wednesday. It wasn't a classic, Barry, was it? unlike most Wales-Ireland games.
And by God, there's a lot of them. Yeah, the one good thing about losing against Wales, again, is there's bound to be another game against Wales on the horizon, because there always is, Wales or Denmark. God, I don't know what to say about the Republic of Ireland anymore. The six games without a goal, 570 minutes since they last scored. They weren't terrible. It wasn't much of a game. And I read out a list of, you know, England players who didn't feature in their lineup. The corresponding list of Irish players isn't quite as sprinkled with fairy dust. We were missing Seamus Coleman, Enda Stevens, John Egan, James McCarthy, Callum Robinson, Aaron Connolly, Alan Brown, and Troy Parrott, if he actually exists. I'm still not convinced. I feel sorry for Stephen Kenny. He can't get a break. Ireland fans, I'm just repeating what I said last week now. Ireland fans, some think he's in over his head. He insists he has a plan. Roy Keane said on the ITV highlights, I did notice that, he doesn't think the Irish players are good enough to carry out Stephen Kenny's plan, and that remains to be seen. But they're playing Bulgaria in a nothing game next week, but I'd say they really, really need a win just to get their confidence off the floor.
Just to say, Barry, you've done two excellent lists. I think lists with Barry Glendenning would be it's a great plan for a show we could pitch to Dave or something. Yeah, Paul Doyle says, look, anyone calling for Stephen Kenny's head already is not thinking straight. The problems the team are suffering from either predate his arrival or have been caused by freakish bad luck, injuries, etc. And amid that, there have been traces of progress, deserves a proper crack at the job. I guess you'd echo that, Baz, would you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think there's any point in appointing a manager if you're not going to give him a decent crack of the whip. And he has been dogged by rotten luck. But still, you know, a couple of goals here and there would just to take the bare luck off the scoreboard would be something.
Yeah, Ireland do need to get something out of that Bulgaria game, I think. Otherwise, if they lose that, I think they're going to get relegated to League C of the Nations League. Is that right?
And then, yes. Is that bad if you're in League C?
It's the sort of the Azerbaijan, Luxembourg, like Faroe Islands sort of zone.
Oh, no, that's League D. They're in D.
Well, Faroes are in D, but they're about to be promoted out of D.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Isn't there an argument for getting relegated in the Nations League? So in the next one, then it's easier for you to qualify, because you get to, you know, in the World Cup playoffs, the two that don't make the playoffs anyway from the Nations League get into the playoffs.
But so, I think if you do get relegated, you end up in your ranking goes down, so you get a tougher group.
That's true. Yeah, you're in a tougher pot. Yeah, you're right.
So it's harder to qualify through qualification, but it's easier to qualify through the Nations League.
Potentially.
What a minefield. Well, maybe
play the long game.
Yeah, maybe Stephen Kenny's a genius. I was very pleased that Stephen Kenny went from shiny Patrick Keelty suit to more considered Football Manager tracksuit. Although I said that he looked like Patrick Keelty in 20 years time, and I checked, and he is actually, you're right, Barry, younger than Patrick Keelty. So there we go. My apologies. Now, Scotland went to Slovakia. Both sides very happy after qualifying. Slovakia won 1-0, so that's Scotland's 9-match unbeaten run coming to an end. The Scots are a point clear of the Czech Republic in Group B2 with one to play. Victory in Israel on Wednesday will win them the section. And should they finish equal on points with the Czechs, Scotland would finish top because of their better head-to-head record. Although, as we've just established, getting promoted from the Nations League is the worst thing you could possibly do. But look, we used up a year's worth of our FitBar quota on Thursday, so we'll move on. Austria 2, Northern Ireland 1. Ian Barraclough's side on course to bounce back from Thursday's playoff defeat to Slovakia when they went 1-0 up late on. Josh McGuinness. Austria scored two late goals. Their equaliser looked offside to me, but lovely work from Marko Arnautovic to set up Austria's winner. I had certainly forgotten of his existence. He plays now for Shanghai SIPG, Joel says, how shocked is Barry that Northern Ireland managed to blow the match in the final 10 minutes?
I'm not shocked. It was sloppy. They should at least have taken a point from the game. But Ian Barraclough, he like Stephen Kenny, is just seems to need a bit of luck as well. But I wouldn't say it was a shock that they lost the game, but it was certainly careless. They should have taken a point. But that Arnautovic threw ball with the outside of his foot. Beautiful.
Wasn't it great? Northern Ireland have Romania next. Romania were meant to play Norway, but that was postponed. Ragnar says, comment on Norway calling up any player based outside of the country to drum up a squad to play Austria. Yeah, they've had to call up an entirely new squad of players based outside of Norway for their game against Austria. There was one positive COVID test in the Norway camp. No other players failed a test. In accordance with UEFA rules, the rest of the squad were free to travel to Romania, but the Norwegian government wouldn't let the team leave the country in order to play the game. So they've cobbled together a new squad, including Ruben Gabrielsen, who sent a great video of him just running with his passport out of his flat, which I liked a great deal.
On that Norway thing, I saw Lars, who obviously wasn't deemed worthy of inclusion in the squad, which is quite the slap in the face for him. He tweeted that the Norwegian government have allowed various players to return to their clubs, so say
right, okay,
Haaland is gone back on condition they conduct their quarantine back in his case Germany. So Lars was saying it would be interesting to see if they do actually feature for their clubs next week when they should be quarantining.
All right, and what happens if they don't? Norway will be angry with them.
Well, Norway will be angry with them, but I think there could be Norwegian repercussions. So.
The Norwegian repercussions sounds like a book Wilson would write that nobody would read. Germany beat Ukraine 3-1. Timo Werner getting a couple. Sergio Ramos missed two penalties. He'd previously scored all of his 25 penalties. He also became the most capped European player of all time. What a topsy-turvy roller coaster for Sergio. Thomas says, Ramos's penalty misses. When have the pod made the same mistake twice? Ideally in the space of 10 minutes, particularly when the first mistake was lamentable and the second mistake egregious. Yeah, his second was a Ademola Lookman bad Panenka. Has anybody made? I don't know if anybody can answer that question.
Oh, it was at a piano recital in 1997. And there was a section that I kept screwing up. And there was about 150 people there. It was the day of the 97 FA Cup final. So I know I was 11. And we get to this section. I've made a mistake. It was like this total silence. And I just kind of seamlessly went back and just played the section again, hoping that no one would notice. And I messed it up again. And because I was 11, and I don't really know why I did this, I just smashed the piano. And like a massive tantrum. And there's like, my parents were there, and my piano teacher was there, and everything. And then there's total silence. And then one of the kind of the judges, who's like this 65-year-old, I'll never forget what he said. He said, "That is no way to treat a piano."
That's a lovely story, Johnny.
I came last.
Oh, bad luck, mate. Daryl says, on the subject of terrible goal music, check out Italy's for their game against Poland. Let me play it to you. Now, we're allowed to play this as long as we review the song. That's officially how it works. So if you could suddenly put your six music hat on while I play you the goal music, which is Un Amore Così Grande by Negro Amaro. Here we are.
And in from Barella for Lorenzo Insigne. Underperformer for the national side, but goal scorer here tonight. Big moment for him and for Ivani. And Italy lead.
I believe that goal was actually disallowed for offside as well. What did you make of the song? It came out in 2014, so we're quite late to review this single in the in the round table we're doing. Steve Lamacq joins us for this. Ed, did you like the song? I quite like a power ballad.
I thought it was excellent, yeah. I think they should probably have a different song for every player when they score, you know, so you have a signature song That'd be quite good, wouldn't it?
Johnny, what did you think of that?
I liked it. Italy's always had a really great underrated tradition of pop music. That sounded like it was the sort of thing that, you know, you could imagine that headlining the San Remo Festival of 1964. It was nice. And a huge improvement on the music that you often get at a lot of Italian grounds, where just before kickoff at Juventus in the Allianz Stadium, the lights go down and they play this horrible thumping Euro dance. It's just like ear splitting. Like, it's just booms. It's just booms and bangs.
It's like an awful racket, Johnny. You want a melody, don't you?
I know. I'm getting old. I mean, I'm 35 this week, and one of the hallmarks of getting old is that you start listening to pop music. It's all the same. It's all the, and you realize, God, it is all the same. But I mean, I suspect that says more about me than it does about anything.
Well, it's a credit to you, Johnny, that you're so authoritative. I had you down for at least 43.
Thank you.
That's okay. Barry, your thoughts on the record?
I thought it was okay. I'm fundamentally against goal music, so I don't think there should be any, even if there is no crowd. But it sounded all right to me.
There we are. Let's see if we get... I did the round table with Steve Lamacq once, but I thought that all of the Beach Boys were dead and they weren't, and so they haven't asked me back. I don't know if they're still with us now. I do hope so.
Brian Wilson certainly is.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. Susie Rack will join us in part three. We'll look back at the weekend in the Women's Super League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Susie Rack joins us for this. Barry, why is your hand up?
Well, I just wanted to do some housekeeping while we were waiting for Susie. I did some research. Just for your information, next time you're on a round table with Steve Lamacq, Max, Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, alive. David Marks, alive. Mike Love, alive. Bruce Johnson, alive. Al Jardine, alive.
Excellent news. Well done to the Beach Boys. So we move from the Beach Boys seamlessly to the Women's Super League, as most shows do. Where do you want to start, Susie? Arsenal 1, Chelsea 1. Late drama and later drama.
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely cracking game, not least for the fact that, you know, we could barely see it for probably 90% of the game because the rain was like lashing in one side and then we had the sun at the same time shining over the stand opposite. But yeah, like really, really thrilling, finely balanced game throughout, very much like tactical battle. And it was really nice to see Viv Miedema sort of make such a nice run, outpace Millie Bright, get round to swinging the cross for Beth Mead's goal, because she often gets accused of not sort of showing up in the big games, and there's not a bigger game than Arsenal-Chelsea in the Women's Super League. So,
I mean, she went past Millie Bright like she didn't exist, didn't she?
I mean, yeah. I mean, Bright's not the fastest, but, you know, when you watch the clip of it, I think it's one of the things that Miedema perhaps doesn't get praised enough for is her turn of pace. You know, she's only 24 and she's got a lot of energy in her legs when she needs to. She's quite good at sort of conserving energy and not necessarily moving too much in the game, but when she needs to, then sort of accelerating away really fast. So that was good. And then it's just pretty gutting for Lotta Wobbamoy, who deflected in Pernell Harder's cross at the end, because she had literally seconds before being announced as player of the match. I mean, literally like seconds. And Joe Montemurro afterwards was saying the announcer cannot be doing that. The announcer cannot be saying it. And then the ball loops over the goalkeeper and into the net. And it was just, you kind of felt for her. She's 21 and she had just played against some of the best strikers in the world in a centre-back pairing with Leah Williamson, who's 23. I really like the future of England, those two. It's an amusing end.
I mean, it was very sort of Gary Mabbott against Coventry in 87. And Sam Kerr could have won it, couldn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an Arsenal fan for my sins, so I wasn't looking too closely at Sam Kerr's effort, but I saw it sail past the far post. She says apparently that the wind had just clipped it like wide of the of going in. But I think that was probably an excuse to her manager. She had a couple of chances that she probably should have gone target, and that's sort of been the story of her journey at Chelsea so far, is almost.
Good comeback from Manchester United against City.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first half, you know, at half time, I was writing a massive, like, homage to Sam Lewis in the middle for City, who was just, like, absolutely untouchable. I mean, she's really tall. She's 6 foot and she just sort of towers over every single player on the pitch and almost looks like she's sort of watching over them like a little giraffe, like just surveying the game. And, you know, was completely unmarked and just in complete control. And you just thought that this was entirely a statement of intent from City that, wait a minute, no, there's no power shift in Manchester. There's no, you know, Man United aren't now title challengers. And then all of a sudden, it just completely switched in the second half. It was the most cliched game of two halves you've ever had. And Tobin Heath's goal came from a Lucy Bronze mistake, which I thought was quite interesting because I love Lucy Bronze. I think she's a fantastic footballer, but I don't think she's quite necessarily hit her best form for Man City yet. So yeah, her mistake, a sort of badly timed pass for Mewis that let Heath in and then lashed this incredible swerving strike that I think's got over a million views on Twitter already off the Barclays Women's Super League tweet of the goal, which is impressive for a women's goal and a women's clip. So and that just launched their fight back. They're really like resilient, gritty, like quite likeable team in that way, Man United. And just really, really got themselves back into it.
I mean, it was a great finish. It was a wonderful strike. Alex Morgan made her first start for Spurs. Susie, we had quite a few questions saying, you know, how is she fitting in? Can she elevate Tottenham all by herself?
I mean, it's a hard task because Tottenham are really, really poor. She had 45 minutes. They started her, took her off at half time, and I mean, she didn't do much. Held up the ball a couple of times. Doesn't get great service. And you can sort of see she's not 100% match fit. So, it's going to need time. She's got to learn the relationship with these players. I think she could strike up a really good partnership with Siri Vorm, who scored a really, really lovely, really, really lovely goal from quite an acute angle from a free kick. And, yeah, I mean, basically, I think she just needs time. And obviously, she's not played before playing for Spurs, not played for a year, had a baby in that time. And I don't know, perhaps I'm as guilty as anyone of hyping up like how influential she has the potential to be when, you know, you're coming back from such a like life-changing physical experience like that. So she just needs time. Spurs are doing so terribly, like she might not kind of fancy it, but it's going to be interesting to see how many more minutes she gets in a Tottenham shirt.
If Spurs are so bad, why did she go there? Is this a kind of just get some match fitness type thing for her?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, in that I imagine a lot of the top clubs wouldn't have been able to take her wage and the type of wage she would command alongside the fact that she's not going to play or is going to barely play. And for Spurs, it was a really, really great marketing opportunity, as well as being, you know, having the potential to come in and influence things and sort of change things up off the pitch as well, because, you know, she demands such high standards and Spurs haven't necessarily always had the best support from the club as a whole. So she sort of raises the bar for them. She needed minutes. She just badly, badly needed minutes. And so she needed a club that was going to give her them. The USA also trained at the Tottenham training ground in the build-up to the World Cup, and I think that sort of endeared her slightly to the club because she knew the training ground a little bit as well.
Five teams, you know, look to sort of be slightly above the others. Do you think those five will be able to sort of sustain the pace and we'll have like a title race involving all of them? You've got United top with Arsenal and Chelsea below them, Everton and then Manchester City.
Yeah, definitely. And that's like what is quite exciting. I think what was quite exciting from the weekend's games is that there were only 2 3-point games. All the others were draws. And those two games were, you know, from teams lower down the table. So it is a much more competitive league. Things are a lot tighter. The games are really, really good to watch. And those five will be battling out. I think Everton have a big problem in that they they had a like star striker Valerie Govan injured in the FA Cup final, but kept her on, and she has now got a muscle injury that's going to sit her out until at least Christmas. So they could have, to try and save the FA Cup final, have like massively hindered their, I suppose, Champions League top four aspirations as a result, because they've been struggling since she's been out. She's such a key goal scorer for them and really, really hit the ground running and linked up really, really well with the team. So she's going to be a big miss. I think they're going to be the team that struggles to sort of stay the pace as long as she's out. But based on... the thing is what's quite... I suppose what's most exciting is that no team has been sort of extremely consistent. You know, you could say Manchester United have in the fact that they're unbeaten and top of the table, but the first half performance against City shows that they can be got at. So that's what's exciting. It's not that there's not a runaway in the same way there has been in recent seasons, where there's just been an obvious team that is in form from the start.
Thanks for coming on, Susie.
No worries, thank you.
Susie right there, our women's football correspondent. Just a bit of admin. The Premier League have dropped the pay-per-view model that hadn't gone down particularly well. They'll show every fixture live on TV until the new year. No pay-per-view matches in sight. Abandoning the $14.95 charge. So there's going to be free-to-air games on the BBC, additional fixtures on Amazon Prime, as well as Sky and BT Sport. Johnny, is this a great reason for celebration and to congratulate football's authorities and the broadcasters? Or is this just, why did they do it in the first place?
It's a sign that very, very few people were prepared to pay for it. We saw the highly organised boycotts that a lot of clubs' fan bases organised, raising money for food banks instead. And I think, you know, some of the rumours that you heard coming out of the broadcast as to how many people were actually watching these broadcasts was, I would imagine, quite alarming, for not just for the clubs, but for the Premier League and for the broadcasters. So it may be the first sign that there isn't this kind of limitless and, you know, eternally milkable audience out there for Premier League football, especially when the football is of, you know, this current quality. So even the Premier League, even something as big and as watched as the Premier League needs eyes on it, and this is really just kind of an acknowledgement of that.
This is from Steve, who says, however you look at this, it's totally wrong at this time. Unbelievable. And this is the fact that Rise of the Foot Soldier was being filmed at Roots Hall. Hundreds of actors celebrating a goal at a stadium, really badly, like actors do, and never quite get it right. Nobody turning to celebrate with their friends or anything. Yet fans are not allowed in stadiums. Obviously, everyone on set is tested before and after, so it's slightly different. But the optics are quite frustrating for actual football fans. Actual South End fans are not allowed to go to Roots Hall, but they're allowed to go if they're celebrating a goal that hasn't happened in Rise of the Foot Soldier.
What is Rise of the Foot Soldier? I've heard of it, but
oh, it's a classic. You guys not seen it?
Is it about a firm?
It's about these guys, and they like fighting, and it's great.
Sounds like an alt-right website.
It pretty much is.
I can confirm, though, I mentioned watching on the iFollow, even if you're not in the stand and you're watching on an exercise bike on iFollow, there is real agony in conceding a 96th-minute equaliser at home to Barrow. Sort of head-in-hands moment, thinking, I remember what this is like. But we're still second in League Two, so that's good. Barry, no news as yet from Carly Rae Jepsen. Yes, if any of our listeners, you know, lots of people listen to this podcast. If any of you know Carly Rae Jepsen, Barry will only allow the video of him lip-syncing to Call Me Maybe while walking the streets of Brixton to be published on social media if we get sign-off from Carly Rae Jepsen. So I'm going to make it. Even if it ruins the whole podcast, I'm going to make it, Barry, my one. This may be my last ever quest, but I will get her on to say, yes, we can show it online. Are you happy with that, Baz?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's me stopping it. It's the law.
Yeah.
And it turns out that all you had to do during the live show last week, for anyone who doesn't know, this was our interval showstopper, all you had to do was review the song, say, oh, that was quite catchy by Carly Rae, and you'd be able to put it wherever you like.
You're absolutely right. Carly Rae, if you're listening, please get in touch. The world needs to see Barry in his big puffer jacket miming to your song. That is almost all we have time for. But on the WhatsApp group, Ed Ahrens really wanted to share his Ian Rush anecdote. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Ed Ahrens' Ian Rush anecdote.
Okay, picture the scene. It's Christmas, I think 2014, roughly. I pulled a cracker, and the prize from my cracker was a fake moustache. So thinking, oh, this is great fun, I put it on. It's one of those ones that clips just into your nostrils, you know? It was a little black one. Yep. So, yeah, I had it on.
Like the man on the Pringles packet.
Yeah, a bit like that, Barry, yeah, a bit like that. And so I had it on, and I went outside for a cigarette, still wearing it. Opened the door. Who was standing at the door? But Ian Rush. But not just Ian Rush. Ian Rush without a moustache. So, because he's obviously shaved it off many years ago. But, you know, to me, he's always had a moustache. Yeah. And to everyone. So I saw him. And I was like, I did a double take, as you would. And then I realised, oh, I'm wearing a fake moustache at the moment. And Ian Rush hasn't got a moustache. So I think I can't remember what I said or something like, oh, hi, Ian, do you like my moustache or something like that? It was, I mean, yeah, pretty much ignored me, I think. But yeah, that was it.
Where were you? Where were you? You were at your house?
I was in a pub on the Wirral.
Ah, right. Okay. Oh, that makes more sense.
Having a Christmas dinner, and there were crackers, and my Christmas cracker present was a fake moustache. And I happened to be Ian Rush whilst wearing it. That's it.
I just love the idea of you being in your house and opening the door and wondering, what is Ian Rush doing on Christmas Day outside your house?
That would be a lovely story.
Thank you for your time, Barry.
You're very welcome, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan Liu.
Thanks. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. Thanks for asking. Thank you, Ed Ahrens.
It's been a pleasure.
Great. Tomorrow, we're going to do a special on mental health in football. And so hopefully you can tune in for that.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.